Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, we begin with something special. Earlier this morning, I co-moderated a Crain's New York Business breakfast interview with New York City Deputy Mayor Richard Bury. As Deputy Mayor for Strategic Policy Initiatives, he's responsible for the implementation of Mayor de Blasio's signature initiative, Universal Pre-K, and two other intriguing things, a children's cabinet, which is supposed to cut across city departments, and 100 new schools that support families outside of school as well as in the classroom. So we're going to play you portions of that breakfast event now, beginning with some of Deputy Mayor Bury's opening remarks. Then you'll hear the questioning by me and Crain's Deputy Managing Editor, Eric Enquist. Born and raised in East New York, Richard Bury joined the de Blasio administration after 5 years as head of the Children's Aid Society. Here is some of what he told the breakfast audience of political and business leaders earlier this morning.
There are currently over 20,000 full-day seats available at public schools around the city. Thanks to our successful outreach effort, over 40,000 families have already applied for seats at these schools. In addition to the public school seats, we also offer pre-kindergarten through community-based early childhood centers. These centers are funded and supervised by the Department of Education and have always been a part of our system. They are subject to the same standards, the same rigorous oversight as our public school system, and they will deliver the same quality education. Right now, parents can apply for the over 15,000 seats that are currently available at community-based early childhood centers. Parents can learn more by going to nyc.gov/pre-k or dialing 311. And on May 30th, we're going to announce over 10,000 additional pre-kindergarten seats in our community-based centers. Parents can apply to these programs starting Friday. On June 5th, parents who apply for pre-kindergarten seats in public schools will be notified about placements in public schools. Those who do not receive an offer will be encouraged to apply for the many high-quality community-based options in centers around the city. And we've launched an ambitious campaign to make sure that parents understand the options that are available in their community, but also understand how to navigate the application process. Over the next month, we'll continue to announce additional pre-kindergarten seats at public schools, at charter schools, at religious schools, and other community-based providers in communities around New York City. Again, we want to make sure that parents have a variety of quality options, and we are opening the systems to all kinds of providers that can demonstrate the ability to operate quality programs. And of course, teachers are at the center of a quality pre-kindergarten system. This summer, the Department of Education will be running a training institute for thousands of new and current pre-kindergarten teachers and teachers' assistants. We have a recruitment plan and training plan to hire up to 1,000 new pre-K teachers beginning this fall. And additionally, again in partnership with our friends at CUNY, Mayor de Blasio has announced an initiative that will certify up to 400 additional professionals by September 2015 through a historic $6.7 million partnership. Building a UPK system over 2 years in a city as big as New York City is unprecedented and it is complex. But it is also a sound investment for our city, both from an educational and business perspective, and one that we are well ready to implement. So let's move from early childhood to middle school. When it comes to after-school programs for middle school students, there's good news and not so good news. The good news is that New York City boasts an unparalleled network of strong after-school programs, many led by providers in this room. Now the bad news. Many middle school students do not participate, often because there is no program located in the school that they attend. The mayor is committed to increasing access to after-school programs for middle school students in a tremendous way. The proposed fiscal 15 budget includes $145 million in new funding to expand after-school. It will support programs in public district schools and public charter schools serving grades 6 through 8 that do not currently offer after-school programs. School principals and community-based organizations will partner to provide programs at no cost to families. Beginning this September, after-school programs will add more than 40,000 new middle school students. This is really a tremendous and unprecedented expansion. And in fiscal year 2016, we will increase that funding to $190 million, allowing us to serve more than 50,000 students year-round. The decision to target middle-school-aged children acknowledges the importance of encouraging adolescents to develop new interests and pursue their passions during a period of life that is often challenging. Now, the father of a rising sixth grader, I'm going to learn that, I think, in a very direct way soon. Research confirms what parents and teachers know in their gut. Sixth, seventh, and eighth graders need safe environments and absorbing activities to occupy them after school. These programs are especially critical for working parents who all too often spend late afternoons hoping their children are not getting into trouble. Participating in after school can also help address and reduce the persistent achievement gap between different income and racial groups. Again, this is an unprecedented expansion requiring collaboration among numerous city agencies and community-based organizations throughout our city. The last major investment I want to discuss briefly is the mayor's commitment to expand the community schools initiative in New York, adding 100 community schools by the end of his first term, something that means very close to me and my colleague Bill Weisberg from the Children's Aid Society. Community schools are an educational strategy designed to ensure that schools have the resources they need to address the multiple barriers that can stand in the way of children's ability to learn. Being a teacher is one of the hardest jobs in the world. Again, I got to shout out my UFT table over there as well. Being a teacher, we know, is one of the hardest jobs in the world. And that's especially true when many of your students come to school hungry, traumatized or depressed, and are regularly missing school because of unstable housing or chronic illness. By weaving together services such as mental health, physical health, adult education, social services, in a coordinated way in the school, community schools can ensure that all students, not just some, but all students can succeed, regardless of the challenges that students bring to the schoolhouse door. In conclusion, you'll be hearing more about universal pre-kindergarten, after-school programs, community schools, and other initiatives from the mayor in the weeks to come. This is just the beginning. But I want to emphasize again that we will look to you, leaders from the nonprofit community and from the business community, to continue to work with us as we take steps to develop and improve the city that we love. We must work together to enhance our educational system and to improve our most vulnerable communities. It is not only our shared responsibility, it is in our mutual best interests. Together, let's make sure that all of our children have a chance to realize their dreams, whether they grew up on the Upper East Side or in East New York. Let me close by quoting one of the greatest leaders of our time, Nelson Mandela. Education is the most powerful weapon with which you can change the world. New York City is poised for positive change, and it is up to us to seize the opportunity. Thank you for your continued support, and I look forward to working with you in the weeks, months, and years ahead. Thank you.
Deputy Mayor Richard Bury speaking earlier this morning at a Crane's New York Business Breakfast. We'll continue in a minute with my interview of Bury following his remarks, along with Crane's Eric Enquist. Stay with us. WNYC. The first part of our show today is the Crane's New York Business Breakfast. I co-moderated this morning with Deputy Mayor Richard Bury, who's implementing the de Blasio pre-K program, creating 100 schools that will support children and families beyond the school day, and he's heading up a children's cabinet to cut across many city agencies. We heard Bury's opening remarks. Now the follow-up interview that I did with Crane's deputy editor, Eric Enquist, it began with this question.
So Richard, we hear a lot from the de Blasio administration about pre-K and after school and about reforms to the regular district schools. The number one factor in whether children succeed is not the quality of their schooling, it's the quality of their parenting, and I think you're a shining example of that, as you mentioned. But what is the administration doing about that, about the issue of bad parenting? And how do you talk about a subject that many in the progressive community regard as a third rail?
Well, I think by the murmurs in the audience, you sort of you may have touched the rail there. Well, let me say a few things. What we know are that parents are the first and more important teacher to their children. So we understand that. And every part of the mayor's reform agenda includes recognizing the central role that parents play and making sure that parents have the support they need to be successful. You see that in the historic teachers contract that Mayor de Blasio and the United Federation of Teachers have negotiated, which, among other things, prioritizes parent engagement and makes sure that parents are welcome and engaged in their school buildings. You see that in the mayor's call to expand community schools, because one of the centerpieces of the community schools initiative is the idea that parents should not only come to schools when there's a problem and when the teacher calls them when there's a problem, but that to truly be a center of learning, the school has to be a place that's welcome to parents. The idea of a community school is that a school operates as a community center, so that you're offering services for parents all the time. At the community schools that Bill and I ran at the Children's Aid Society, you find parents coming for GED classes, for arts classes. Parents are part of the community. You see that in quality early childhood programs, which a quality early childhood program has a strategy for engaging parents. You're working not only on educating children in the classroom, but you're working on a strategy for supporting parents to support their children's learning at home. So I think for us, everything that we try to do to build a stronger system for children begins with a recognition that strong children live in strong families who live in strong communities. These are not disconnected, and you can't look at them in isolation. So we do recognize and understand the important role of parents, the primary role that parents play in supporting their children's development. But we also recognize that the way to support families and to support parents is by building a system that is designed to give their children a quality education in a fair and equitable way, and that at every point of the way we have to make sure that we're thinking about the roles that parents play in supporting and being a part of that system.
Well, think about it, but you haven't actually talked about it that much. I mean, we just hear pre-K, pre-K, pre-K. We don't hear anything about parenting. You know, Obama has talked more about it than the mayor has. He talks about parents should turn off their TV and read to their children. I mean, we've seen all the stats about how upper-income kids are hearing 3 million vocabulary words by age 3, and lower-income kids are hearing one-tenth as much. I mean, what is the mayor actually doing to engage parents, other than adding those 40 minutes a week for teachers to do parent outreach?
Well, again, Eric, I think we have to understand that these are not disconnected or separated ideas, right? We do understand that one of the main drivers of the achievement gap are the differential investments that wealthy parents are able to make in their children's education. That's not because that low-income parents don't care about their children. It's not because low-income parents don't love their children. It's because too often low-income parents don't have the resources to engage their children in high-quality opportunity and activities. One of the ways, for example, that wealthier families are able to invest in their children's education is by engaging their children in high-quality education programs, the way that I did for my own children when they were that age. So when we talk about building a quality pre-kindergarten system, we're not talking about something separate from parents. We're talking about giving parents the tools and resources they need to be the parents that they want to be by giving them a partner who can help their children get ready for kindergarten. Because parents can't do this alone. That's part of the message. If you're a low-income parent in the South Bronx or in East New York or East Harlem, working to make ends meet, dealing with substandard housing, you as a parent can't do that alone. And giving speeches telling you to work harder, work harder, work harder to be a parent is all well and good, but what we need to do is to give parents tools and resources and support. And that's what we're trying to do. Give parents the tools and resources and support they want to be the parents that they desperately want to be. That's why we want to build after-school program, make sure that every middle school parent can offer that to their kids, thing that parents would do if they could afford it and they had access to it. So again, I don't think we're talking about something different. We just want to build more than lip service to it. We want to actually build the system that parents can rely on to be the parents they want to be.
So could you talk more about that, specifically with relation to the 100 community schools that I understand are supposed to not just educate the kids in school, but also support families, health services, involvement with parents, things like that? Would you describe that as sort of a Harlem Children's Zone model? And what would the specific engagement with parents be like? What would it look like? What would the teachers and principals be doing? And is that much more expensive than the traditional model where the kids just go home at 3 o'clock or after school? Will you be spending the same or more per child at those community schools?
Sure. Well, I would call it the Children's Aid Society model because I'm biased. But what I would really say is this, right? Here in New York City, we're building on a great reservoir of experience. There are organizations like the Harlem Children's Zone, like the Children's Aid Society, like the Beacon School Initiative, Good Shepherd Services. There are organizations around the city, often by different names, but you don't always call them community schools, that operate what is essentially a community schools model. And the core of the model is this, the basic idea is this, that to be a great school, you of course need great teaching, great school leadership. You need strong after-school and extracurricular programs. But you also need a strategy to meet the needs of children where they live. Which means addressing the myriad needs that children bring with them to the schoolhouse. And that's why organizations like the United Federation of Teachers have done so much work recently to educate the world, educate the city about community school initiatives, not only in New York, but around the country that have been successful. But what I would say is a core idea is not necessarily just about adding new money, although in many cases, you will have communities that will have a dearth of services. We know, for example, that there is a real dearth of mental health services available for children, and there are going to be places where, of course, we're going to have to invest more resources. But the central innovation of a community school is not necessarily more money for more programs. It is thinking about how do you organize services in a way that actually meet children where they need. And so one of the things that we do is we have a resource coordinator, a community schools director. Again, you can call it a different thing in each school building. But the idea is that at the heart, you have a full-time resource in every school whose job it is to help understand what the needs of that community are and to connect that community to other resources around the neighborhood that can benefit families. But rather than having these services scattered around the community so that the parent has to go to this place for health services and go this place for the after-school program, you bring them in the school building and you spend the time organizing those resources so that for parents and teachers, access to the services are seamless. So yes, there are definitely investments involved. But the core investment is not around new money, it's in better organization of resources to that they're delivered to families in a seamless way.
Is there a dollar figure that you can estimate that would be more than is typically spent on a public school child for those who will be in these community programs?
We're planning right now, so we're spending a lot of time this summer really planning to see what it would take to build a system at scale, both from a resource perspective and from an organizational perspective. So we'll hear more about that soon. And again, over the next weeks and months, you're going to be hearing more and more about this community schools initiative moving forward and what it will take to build that system at scale as well.
So the justification for early childhood education comes largely from studies that were conducted decades ago of very small, high-quality programs that have never been replicated at the kind of scale that you're envisioning. And that $1 investment that produces a $7 return, I mean, that's an example of extrapolating from one of these small studies. What makes you think that your pre-K will be any more effective than, say, Head Start?
So two things. You're referring, I think, to the Perry Street School study and the I can never pronounce it right, but the Abecedarian study. So I say a few things. One is that those studies, which were very expensive program but also very expensive evaluation studies, really did establish a bedrock for what extremely high-quality early childhood education could do. But it's not the only research that shows the impact and quality of a high-quality system. And many, including our colleagues at NYU and others, have done a really good job of collecting all the evidence that show how a high-quality system can support early learning and get kids ready for kindergarten. So the first thing I would say is that is not the only research that demonstrates the impact of a high-quality pre-kindergarten. The other thing I would say about Head Start is I think it's a mistake to say that, you know, Head Start is not a program, right? Head Start is a funding source. And Head Start funds quality programs, and it funds poor quality programs. And so it doesn't make sense to look at Head Start and say, well, Head Start is not a good program, and investing in these services won't necessarily work. The issue for us is to build a quality program and to make sure that we are building a quality pre-kindergarten system, because we know that a quality pre-kindergarten system will lead results for children entering school. So again, a lot of our work has been around what does it take to build not just a pre-kindergarten system, but what does it take to build a high-quality pre-kindergarten system. So we think about things like evaluating programs and making sure that the programs that are applied have the capability to deliver a high-quality experience. That they have experience in early childhood, they have strong leadership. And so a lot of our work is in evaluating the programs that are applying and making sure that these programs are up for the challenge. And so we only approve about 50 to 60% of the programs that are applied. So the first thing that we're doing is we're making sure that we're bringing quality providers into the system.
And a very brief follow-up.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Head Start has also been criticized, but it's not an integrated program. I mean, it only serves kids in poverty. How will your program be integrated? We have some of the most segregated schools in the country. Why would the Early Childhood Initiative be any less segregated than our current schools are?
Well, let me finish this thought and get to that. So just to finish a few other thoughts on quality, and again, without going into too many details, the investments in teachers that we're making, the investments in Department of Education that we're making, we're increasing the department's capacity to provide coaching, support, and oversight to these schools. So we're really making massive investments, not just in growing the size of our system, but in making investments in the quality of our system. And we're looking to districts around the country, like in Boston and other places, that have had some success in building quality systems. Now, the thing about New York is that what we're doing, the scale of what we're doing, dwarfs anything that's happened in any system around the city. So the other thing that I think we have to acknowledge is that this is going to be a work in progress. We're going to make a lot of investment in building a quality system, but everything's not done this fall or the next fall. Part of our work of the system is to continue to invest, continue to innovate, to make sure that we're improving the quality of our system over time. So that's the first thing that we're saying. The second thing that you talk about is segregation in the public school system, which we know, particularly in this, the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. It is daunting to think how little progress we've made in some ways in improving integration into the system. So again, what we've done here in New York is we really have worked to build a system that is diverse, and diverse in the sense of the opportunities that are available to parents. You will have public schools. You will have small community-based organizations, large community-based organizations. You will have charter schools, religious schools, parochial schools, yeshiva schools, all sorts of different schools that exist to provide this system. And part of what we're trying to do is to make sure that we're doing a good job of communicating to parents what opportunities are available in their city, whether it's in their neighborhood, whether it's where they work. And our job is to make sure that parents have as much information as possible so that they can find the resource that's best for them, but also to make sure that all these programs are operating at a level of quality so that we can be sure that all parents have access to the kind of program that they can be comfortable with, that they can feel safe with, that they know will be helping their kids get ready for school.
On that question of ensuring quality, if this will be part of the system and we start saying pre-K through 12 rather than K through 12, will there be common core standards for pre-K? For example, kindergarten has common core standards. I found these on corestandards.org. Kindergarten language arts, print many upper and lowercase letters, use frequently occurring nouns and verbs, form regular plural nouns orally by adding S or ES, understand and use question words. So those are very specific pre-K core common core standards. What might some pre-K common core standards be, and would they be in effect from day one?
So pre-kindergarten, and part of our requirement for all providers, so that pre-kindergarten programs are aligned with state standards for learning, much in the way that kindergarten or first or fifth grade would be. Now, we want to be clear about what that means. Common standards do not mean testing. So it doesn't mean that we're going to be issuing a series of standardized tests to four-year-olds in pre-kindergarten standards in classrooms. What it doesn't mean is that we have standards for the experience that children are supposed to have in their pre-kindergarten experience. Those experiences include what you would expect in a four-year-old classroom. They include robust play, socialization, because these are some of the capacity that we want children to have before they start school. We want them to be able to engage with their peers, to have the pre-literacy skills that are going to be critical to be able to go into a kindergarten classroom and to begin to learn those academic skills. So absolutely, the idea is to have strong standards and to help providers meet those standards. But we want to be clear about what it means. It does not mean children going into a classroom at the age of four and taking a set of standardized tests. It does mean being serious about making sure that we are delivering programs of quality. And again, those qualities are absolutely aligned to state standards about what four-year-olds should be experiencing before
they start
school.
So are there standards for socialization? For example, I looked at a Montessori site which listed for their schools some standards and what they call practical life activities offered to assist the child in developing a sense of order, concentration, personal pride, independence, respect for others, fine motor skills, grace and courtesy, confidence and self-esteem. Are those things that are going to be particular metrics and standards?
They include things like executive functioning, like being able to, the ability to make plans and follow through on actions. When you have organized play, and kids are playing, and they're playing to be in the kitchen, they're playing to be chefs in the kitchen, or they're playing to be a doctor. What children are doing is they're learning. They're learning skills. They're learning socialization skills. They're learning to imagine, to tell stories. They're the common sense thing that you would expect you'd want four-year-olds to learn. But they don't happen without intentionality. They don't just happen because you put four-year-olds in the room. They happen with trained teachers, with quality vetted curriculum implemented strongly. They happen with regular professional development with a strong feedback loop that teachers are understanding whether students are getting the skills they're
supposed to gain. So teachers will be evaluated on concepts like those?
In every quality educational program, you have to have a structure for making sure that teachers are getting strong feedback for the program they're delivering in the classroom. And it's not punitive, but it is absolutely making sure that they have the supervision and support to do the job that they want to do. To do the job that they're being trained to do and to do the job that they are being paid to do. So absolutely. We're trying to build a quality system, and part of the way that we should be held accountable as a city is making sure that the investments that we make in four-year-olds are actually paying off in the long term in terms of children's preparation for school. And that's what we want to understand in the long term, that these investments are actually delivering the results we want them to deliver.
Thank you.
Okay. By the way, if anyone cannot hear is having trouble hearing, just wave your arms, and I'll remind Richard of talking into the microphone. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned a lot of kids come to school hungry. Every student in New York City public schools can walk into school and get a free breakfast. But many of them do not. Even the hungry kids. Why is that happening? What can be done about it?
So I'm not an expert on food nutrition. But what I would say is this, is that part of the strategy of a strong community school model is actually to understand what are the barriers that stand in the way of children succeeding, including what are the barriers that stand in the way of children accessing the services that are available to them. And that's why I said it's not just about new money for new services. It's also about understanding why children and families are not accessing the resources that are already available to them in their community. So I think a strong school is not just passively waiting for kids to show up for breakfast. A strong community school is going out proactively and understanding who are the children who have needs, who are not coming to breakfast, and why aren't they coming. A strong community school has a strategy then for reaching out to those families and saying, here are the things we can do for you at this school. Come take advantage of it. And so again, it's not just about new services. It's about actually connecting individual children and individual families to the resources that children and families need, many of which can already be available in the community, but which are not being taken advantage of.
Just a quick follow-up. So the city council is pushing for now free lunch for all students. Is there a stigma associated in your mind with free lunch that's preventing kids from getting access to that free and reduced price lunch? And so far, the mayor has resisted the idea of changing the system that we have where some kids get free lunch, some kids get reduced price, and some kids have to pay.
First of all, let me say, I don't think it's fair to say that the mayor is resisting that idea. I think it's fair to say that the Department of Education continues to explore the idea. And so this is an ongoing process. It's a complicated issue, and so it's a process that's ongoing. But yes, I think at the core of the idea is that absolutely there can be stigma associated with free and reduced lunch. And so part of what the Department of Education is exploring are various ways to address the stigma. But I wouldn't say that this is a done deal. I think it's constantly being under evaluation. And we're continuing to think about what is the best way to approach the problem. But the goal is, again, to make sure that every child has access to what they need, including two or three square meals a day.
You talked in your opening remarks about the community-based organization options for pre-K and how you're going to aim for parity with the public school seats in terms of quality. And I have a couple of questions mm-hmm. about that. One is, what is the city doing to help parents navigate all these community-based organization options? Our WNYC News Education Department looked at the pre-K directory, and they say it's one long spreadsheet of community-based organizations with phone numbers attached. And they ask, are parents supposed to call each one to find out how many seats are available, to get info on providers and what the philosophy is, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. So that's a great question. So we are in the relatively early stages of a massive campaign to educate families about the early childhood system, the UPK system, but also to give parents the tools to find programs that work for them. So there are a number of things that families can do now, and there are a number of things that we're working to build to make it easier for families. So one thing that families can do now is they can dial 311, and 311 operators are trained to help families make connections. And that does not mean giving you a list of services, but telling you what's available in your neighborhood, what's available by your zip code, either by work or by home. Similarly, you can text pre-K to 877-877 with your zip code and immediately get information about pre-K options that exist near you. We are building better online tools to make sure that parents can do an easier searches for providers that are available, including by things like hours, special community they serve, special focus that a program might have. So we're also improving the online tools to make it easier for parents. We're also building almost a campaign-like capacity to make sure that if parents call in, if parents fill out an online application, which again you can do by going to nyc.gov/pre-K, to make sure that if parents do that, we have a team of staff who can follow up with parents individually and help connect them to the service that makes sense for them. So what we have to recognize is that this is really a new system, in a sense. It's built an existing system, but to build a truly universal system is new. We're significantly increasing the capacity of the system. And because of the nature of our system, there are lots of different providers that families can go to. So we understand that it can be challenging for families. And every family of a four-year-old, you know, in a lot of ways, it's probably going to be a new process for them. We understand that it can be a challenging system. So we're doing everything that we can to bridge those gaps by making sure that we have a strong media campaign about what's happening, but also by creating real and workable tools so that an individual family has a pretty easy process to figure out what program makes sense for them and how to apply.
And further on this question of parity, my understanding is that the state budget identifies a two-tiered reimbursement system. Classes that have teachers without early childhood certification, this would only be in the community-based organizations, would get reimbursed $7,000 per child, while classes with teachers that have their early childhood cert in place would get $10,000 per child. If that's the case, how is the city going to ensure parity of quality from those with the certified to those with the uncertified teachers, and that might mean between regular public schools and the community-based organizations?
So thanks, Brian. That's a great question. So what the state bill does provide for is a differentiated reimbursement model. This is the city's reimbursement, not the provider's reimbursement. But the city gets reimbursed differently based on whether a classroom is led by a certified teacher or an uncertified teacher, which is a situation that only exists in community-based early childhood centers. And so, again, there's a few things that we're doing. One is we all share the goal of making sure that every child is taught by a qualified, experienced teacher. And so part of our goal is to really build the capacity to move teachers towards certification, that they're getting the skills and credentials they need that we think will make them better educators. And that's central to our partnership with CUNY, which I think will be the first part of building the capacity to make sure that teachers are being certified. We've also worked to really invest in community-based providers to allow them to improve and increase salaries so that their salaries can be more competitive with what you find in the public school system. And we also work individually with providers on their individual budgets to make sure that they are giving budgets in a way that allow them to have whatever they need to implement a quality system. So whether or not a classroom has a certified teacher or a non-certified teacher in front of it, those classrooms are held to the same quality standards. They have to deliver the same services to children, and we provide the same level of support. And in fact, part of the reason that the Department of Education is investing in its ability to provide coaching and support in these classrooms is to make sure that we can actually target those classrooms that need additional support, whether led by a certified teacher or not, so that every classroom gets what it needs to be successful.
If you could do that and actually achieve parity, does it mean certification doesn't really matter?
No, it doesn't mean that certification doesn't matter. Because what we know that certification provides, we know that certification is a marker of a teacher, of an educator, investing in their professional development, investing in their training. So there is no teacher in this world, and I'm sure the UFT would agree, that did not benefit from continued investments in professional development. There's no teacher in the world, and that's true for certified teachers or non-certified teacher. And the training and professional development does not end just because you're certified. But what this does do is it allows us to make sure that all teachers are receiving the same baseline level of investment, training, and support. And again, we're trying to build a system to make sure that all teachers have that support, while at the same time, we're not using the fact that a classroom may not have a certified teacher in front of it in the first year as an excuse for not making sure that those children do not get what they need. We're going to make sure that every UPK classroom, wherever delivered, is operating at the same quality, at the same standards as any Department of Education classroom, or it's our job to bring it up to the same standard if it's not meeting that standard initially.
Thank you.
So you went to Stuyvesant. More than 25,000 kids, eighth graders, take the test for Stuyvesant, Brooklyn Tech, Bronx High School of Science, and the other specialized high schools each year. In 2012, Stuyvesant offered admission to exactly 9 black students. 9 out of those 25,000 plus who took the test. Now, the mayor has expressed reservations about the admission system, which is based entirely on this one test, the test that you took, the test that I took all those years ago. But Albany controls that system. Has the mayor or will the mayor make any effort to get Albany to change that system?
So that's a great question, and as you know, I mean, I deeply share those concerns and reservations. As we look at admissions to the specialized schools over the past decade, over the past several decades, what we see is an alarming decline in the number of African American and Latino students who are admitted to these schools. And I think we as a city have to do two things. One is our fundamental job is to make sure that every school, every high school in New York City, that they will deliver a quality education to children. While at the same time, we have to make sure that some of the gems in our system are providing services to children in our communities in an equitable way. And I started by saying, I think, unfortunately, we can't say right now that our public school system is making investments in children in an equitable way. So I share the mayor's concerns. And it is sad, it is tragic when you look at admission to Stuyvesant High School, that only 9 black students would be admitted. So again, it's something that we absolutely have to work on. The mayor is not satisfied with that result. I know the chancellor is not satisfied with that result. And so we're going to continue to work with all of our partners, with educators, with the state, I'm sure, to try to find solutions to make sure that schools like Stuyvesant and Science and Bronx Tech, Stuyvesant, Bronx Science, and Brooklyn Tech, I forget the other name. The other schools aren't quite as important, of course, as Stuyvesant.
But that those Stuyvesant schools, bias right there.
I couldn't resist. And making sure that those schools continue to deliver a high-quality education to our gifted and talented students in New York City, but making sure that those schools and that real opportunity is delivered in an equitable fashion. Because it's not just a test, of course. It's that there's middle schools around the city where only a handful of kids even apply to the specialized schools. There are schools around the city where students are taking test prep. They could be admitted to those schools. And there are other schools where kids are seeing the test for the first time when they walk in. There's a lot that we have to do to make admission to those schools fairer. And I know that the mayor is going to be looking at those opportunities over the years.
The mayor's other big anti-inequality initiative, which you mentioned earlier, through education, is universal middle school after school, in addition to pre-K, mm-hmm. which I've heard him in speeches put on par with universal pre-K as a vital tool. Are you in charge of implementing that too? And after school seems to me like it might be much harder than pre-K for quantifying the effects. So do you plan to have metrics for after school as well? And do you put it on a par with pre-K for reducing inequality in New York City?
That's a great question. I do think that expanding middle school after school programs to schools around the city is a critical tool to helping to advance the mayor's agenda of addressing inequality. For all the reasons that I described, now when I talked about the differential investments that wealthier parents are able to make in their children's education, it's not limited to early childhood education. It also includes the enrichment activities that young people benefit from. We are absolutely committed to making sure that programs, middle school after school programs, are delivering at high quality. Again, just like any other program, a program that's not at high quality, a program that is just glorified babysitting, or their kids just running around, they may be a real benefit for families in terms of child care, but they're not going to deliver the type of investment that we want them to make. But we also have to be careful as well. I know that for my children, I spend basically every weekend that I'm not working, shuttling my older son to basketball games and shuttling my younger son to baseball games. And my kids do piano lessons, and they do the art classes, and all the things that manic middle school parents do for their kids. But when I do these things, I'm not doing them because I expect an immediate payoff in terms of my children's fourth grade ELA scores. And I'm not doing it because I expect some impact study to tell me that because my child took piano lessons, that they're going to pass the specialized high school admissions test when they were in 11th grade. We do these things because we know that for every child, the ability to participate in enriching developmentally appropriate activities like music and arts and sports, it builds their capacity as learners. It gives them a sense of mastery. It teaches them about teamwork and friendship. It enriches their lives and their souls. And ultimately, what we need to be able to do is deliver that value for every children in the city. And my child shouldn't have access to those arts program and those piano lessons simply by the fact that they won some cosmic lottery because their mom and dad can afford it. We want to make sure that every child has access to those services. So yes,
but you want a, good, want to make sure you want a good arts program. You want a good music program.
Exactly.
So how are you going to measure that?
Exactly. And so part of our work now, and my colleague at the Department of Youth and Community Development, led by Commissioner Bill Chong, we're actually working right now to understand how do we evaluate the quality of those programs. But it's not going to be by students filling out a bubble test. That's not how we're going to evaluate the quality of those programs. And again, it builds on strong systems through observation, through implementation studies to make sure that these programs are delivered in a quality way. So yes, our job is to make sure that we're delivering quality programs, but we want to be careful about what a quality program means. It does not necessarily translate into elevated test scores. It's about making sure that the quality of experiences between children and staff is delivered consistently and at high quality.
So our marijuana laws and their enforcement involve a lot of young people in the criminal justice system, apparently to their detriment. On the other hand, marijuana use is associated with decreased academic performance. Where do you come down in this debate, continuing debate over marijuana and its legalization and its enforcement?
So, Eric, that is a wonderful question, which which I am going to demur, which I'm going to pass on. And as you know, there's a good conversation going on among the public, among the city council, among our DA in Brooklyn, among our police commissioner and mayor, and I know there'll be more to come as that conversation continues. How was that? Is it okay? All right. Thank you.
So let me ask you something that you might be more comfortable with. The Dasani series in the New York Times. Most of us in this room, I think, read it. It was a fascinating, riveting series. I'm wondering, now you've been on the front lines of the poverty issue for years in New York City. What, if anything, surprised you about that series? What was your takeaway from reading that?
You know, I honestly don't know that I would say that there was anything about the series about Dasani that surprised me. What I would say is how important it is to continue to tell stories about the way that too many New Yorkers live and breathe. And so I guess if there was anything that was surprising, it was that there was so much surprise about that story, which in many ways just reflects maybe that I live in a little bit of a bubble, because most people that I talk to and spend my time with are people, as you say, who work in the social services sector, who work in the government, who deal with these issues on a daily basis. So I think the importance of stories like that is that it helps sharpen all of our attention in terms of the struggles that our poor neighbors, including folks who live 10 blocks from here, 10 blocks from the Yale Club, experience every day. And our real job is to make sure that we don't focus attention only when the Times runs a 5 or 6 piece story. We as a society have to figure out a way to elevate the challenges of all of our citizens to the front pages every day. And how do we make the challenges of Dasani and young people like her, how do we elevate that to a central policy priority? And I think in a lot of ways, that's what Mayor de Blasio was trying to do, to elevate this to a central policy priority.
I think if there was one thing that would have made a social services provider cringe when reading that series is the scene where Dasani's mother schleps her 8 children and stepchildren across the city to a counseling session, not because she considers the counseling worthwhile in any way, just to get the $10 in cab fare per child that she was entitled. What does that tell you about government services and the way they're delivered and received in this city?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question, so I'll try to answer it and tell me if I'm getting it.
Well, this is a case of where the government had put out these services, made these services available to people, but the writer portrayed them as totally worthless, and apparently the family received them that way.
Well, I don't know that I took the article to be saying that the services were worthless or that the mother perceived them that way. What I would say is a number of things. I think that one thing that we have to remember is that at its core, poverty is a problem of money, the problem of resources. And so to say that a mom who is struggling on the edge to get her kids fed, to give them good housing, would make decisions on the basis of money is not, to me, a critical about the family. I make all sorts of decisions regarding money, including on the mornings where I don't feel like getting out of work. Sometimes I get out of bed because I'm making decisions about money. I think we all make decisions and do things for money. So I would not, and maybe this is not what you're saying, but I don't want to be critical if we say that the family makes a decision motivated by money. Who needs money is not a critical decision. I would not be critical of a family for that
reason.
Understood.
And Mayor Bloomberg, I think, shared that impression, and he set up this program where people would get paid cash based on making good decisions. You make good decisions, you send your kids to school, you send your kids to the doctor, you get a cash payment. It didn't work, and the program was canceled. Why do you think that didn't work? And how does the de Blasio administration's philosophy differ?
Well, let me step back for a second and get to the program. I think you're talking about Family Rewards and Opportunity NYC. To step back for a second, I think part of what that story tells us is that in order to deliver services effectively for families, we have to find a way to make the delivery of those services more seamless. I think the challenge I took away from that story was not so much to criticize the services or to criticize that mom because of their behavior. What I took away is that how hard it was for that mom to navigate access to services, how many barriers stand in the way, barriers that I think often we would not consider. Getting from place A to place B for a poor working family is often the biggest barrier to services because just the logistics of getting there, whether it's paying car fare or not going to work and giving up your hourly wage because you're going to take the time to do this and not that, are often the biggest barriers to services. So go to your question. We don't have time to go deeply into the conditional cash transfer program, which I think you're describing. I don't think the idea wasn't that it didn't work. I know that the Center for Economic Opportunity continues to run that pilot. They adjusted the pilot in order to learn from the first experiment to see how that program would work better in the future. But again, I think all of us who are in the business of trying to support families in need, it behooves us all to be open-minded. I think when you look at the amount of money that we as a society spend in research for drugs to combat erectile dysfunction, and if you compare that to the amount that we spent in research to understand what drives education forward and what drives and what would combat policy, it is shameful. And so I would really, I would encourage, whether or not a particular research pilot works or not, I think we should always encourage us to continue to investigate and put resources into learning what works for families and what doesn't. Because we have a long way to go, and there is nothing more important to us as a society than making sure that we understand how to help young people living in poverty escape that poverty. It's critical to our conceptions of justice, it's critical to the American dream, and it's critical to the long-term viability of our economy.
We have about a minute and a half, Ryan, so you can ask one last quick question.
One last question. And since I've been emphasizing feedback in my questions, you'll be happy to know that my producer, Jody Avergan, up in the wings, texted the number that you mentioned, and lo and behold, it worked. He found pre-K in his neighborhood. In a very nice display, it replied, "Thank you for your interest. Reply with your zip code or address to find a high-quality pre-K program near you." He entered 11216, and then he got this whole list, which starts with nearby center with pre-K, Bambi Daycare, Hancock Street, Bedford-Stuyvesant Economic Community Development Corporation. So there you go. CBO preschool was identified, and another one below it. So if the big overarching goal of pre-K is to reduce inequality, how and how soon will you know if these initiatives are achieving anything toward that end? Is it metrics in third grade? And, of course, I understand why you don't want it all to come down to bubble tests. Of course, mm-hmm. It shouldn't. Is it income of the parents who can now blast through some of the barriers you were just talking about to get more work for themselves after being able to put their kids in full-day programs and after-school programs? Do we have to wait until K through 12 is done for these first groups and graduation rates? How do you really know that it's reducing inequality?
It's really an all-and answer to that question. And as we all know, evaluation can be a tricky business. But in the short term, we're going to be looking at quality metrics. We're going to be looking at some of the participation metrics. We're going to be looking at doing some small-scale studies to see how individual children are benefiting from the program, to really see how children are progressing in terms of kindergarten readiness. And then over the longer term, we're going to be looking at precisely some of the things that you talked about, third-grade test scores and longer-term impact. We want to understand over the long term how this investment drives quality and drives impact. But of course, we can't wait till young people are graduating from high school to know if it's working. So we'll have a combination of short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term goals. And I know you're going to do a good job of holding us accountable to see if the impact is what it's supposed to be.
I'm going to call Jill Kaplan, our publisher, back to the podium. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Deputy Mayor Richard Bury.
Deputy Mayor Richard Bury, speaking earlier this morning at a Crane's New York Business Breakfast. And that was opening remarks that we heard earlier. And then the interview, we played the full interview by me and Crane's New York Deputy Editor Eric Enquist, took place at the Yale Club. So I hope you got a lot out of that. Excuse me, with the deputy mayor who's in charge of implementing the pre-K initiative and the 100 community schools that are going to have supports for children outside the normal ones that schools offer. So there you go. Live interview this morning at over breakfast, and we aired it just now with a very influential, though not yet well-known, deputy mayor in the de Blasio administration, Richard Bury.